My name is Anthony King, and I'm telling the stories behind your favorite cop movies. This is the all-new Neon Badges, Salem Horror Fest edition. William Lustig, at one time known as one of the kings of 42nd Street, was born in the Bronx in 1955. Bill was born with muscular dystrophy and spent much of his childhood on crutches and in a wheelchair. At 11 years old, Bill and his family moved out of the Bronx to Englewood, New Jersey. Because of his condition, Bill's mother would drive him to weekend matinees to escape the rest of the family, where he'd spend the day in the movie theater watching action and horror movies. World War II films, his favorites, with Clint Eastwood, like Where Eagles Dare and Kelly's Heroes, or The Dirty Dozen, or Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, Bullet with Steve McQueen, James Bond pictures, stuff like that. Although he was never a fan of the California pictures coming out of the Roger Corman factory.
They're wild and no angels, law-defying, getting their kicks from violence and torture. The Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra.
In 1969, when Bill was 14 years old, he'd travel into the city to Times Square and 42nd Street, where he first discovered Dario Argento and Mario Bava. So picture this, a 14-year-old Bill Lustig walking down 42nd Street past all the porno theaters. You had the Rialto 1 and 2 playing all the sex movies, but then you had movie palaces like The Lyric that was playing all the new exploitation films, or The New Amsterdam that was playing all the big Hollywood releases. So as you can see, it's really a common misconception that 42nd Street was a place that only played porno films and where you could get a 25-cent blowjob from a transvestite hooker in the alley behind the Rialto. You had your theater dedicated to westerns, you had your art house theater playing Fellini and Bergman, you had your studio pictures and your independent features and everything in between. He says if you had money in hand, you could go see whatever the hell you wanted. And it was there that young Bill Lustig fell in love with horror, and he mostly gravitated towards European horror. See, at 14, Bill was deeply interested in film. He was already reading the trade papers religiously before he could even drive. Now, although this is where Bill developed a love for the genre, he remembers the first horror film he ever saw was Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. He remembers seeing Psycho on TV and Carnival of Souls, which never fails to scare him, and to this day he calls it the scariest movie he's ever seen. But it was in Times Square in 1969 where he really fell in love. He was 14 and he knew he wanted to make movies. He didn't want to be sitting in school or playing with his friends. He wanted to be out there making movies. Around this time, a friend of the family sort of took Bill under his wing. Frank Petrella, aka Peter Savage, was an independent filmmaker who was mostly making porno at this time. He and Bill would talk about high art movies whenever Pete came around to visit. He was a mob guy, so he was well connected and could usually get what he needed to make his little movies. Now, Savage knew Bill's family through Bill's uncle, Jake LaMotta the boxer. Savage was actually the catalyst for Raging Bull. He ended up writing some bullshit book about LaMotta, sold that to Scorsese and De Niro, who then rewrote the whole thing to tell the actual story of Jake LaMotta, and ended up making their masterpiece several years later. Anyways, through Savage, Bill met Ralph Serpy, a small-time producer who was very friendly to Bill and gave him his first job as a PA on Barry Shear's Across 110th Street. After that, Bill started working closely with Pete Savage on his little indie films and pornos like Hypnorotica. Now, because of Savage's connection to Raging Bull, he got Bill a gig working as a PA with Dino De Laurentiis, syncing dailies on films like Crazy Joe and Death Wish. De Laurentiis eventually backed out because of Scorsese and De Niro's insistence on delaying production so De Niro could put on weight, blah 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 blah. The point is, Bill Lustig was now working in the film biz. He assisted, directed, and worked second unit on a few of Peter Savage's films. He worked as apprentice editor on Death Wish, and he PA'd on Across 110th Street, Crazy Joe, and the 7-Ups, which is where he met one of his closest friends, Joe Spinell. While Bill considered Savage his mentor, he always dampened Bill's love of horror. Spinell, on the other hand, loved that about Bill. Joe would call Bill up at 3 in the morning, and they go down to 42nd Street to watch horror and exploitation movies in the early hours of the day. Later, when Bill and Joe made Maniac, Bill's local theater in New Jersey put his name above the title on the marquee, which impressed the hell out of Savage, and he finally saw the worth in the genre. So between AD and PA gigs, Bill drove a truck for an auto parts company. The thing was, though, that Bill hated getting all that grease all over his hands and clothes, so he always told the mechanics to put the dirty spark plugs and belts and whatnot in a bag. Thus, Billy Bag was born. Having worked on porno sets, Bill knew how to make a porno, and he knew he could make some decent bread while doing it. So in 1977 and 78, Bill wrote and directed two porno films, The Violation of Claudia, starring one of the biggest names in the porn world at the time, Sharon Mitchell, and Hot Honey. He used the nickname the guys at the garage gave him, Billy Bag, for the simple reason because he knew these guys would close down the shop on the weekend afternoons and watch 8mm porno films, and he wanted them to see the name Billy Bag come across the screen, and they'd know exactly who that was.
Lock your doors, but you can't lock the madman out of your mind.
So with the 30 grand he made from the two pornos, 12 grand from a producer, and 6 grand from Spinell's work on Cruising, Bill made a splash with his first feature, Maniac. After Maniac came Vigilante with Robert Forster and Fred Williamson. With two grindhouse classics under his belt, Bill was on a roll, but suddenly, nothing. He just had two box office successes under his belt, but the work just stopped. Bill had been going back and forth about moving out to California. He'd spent his whole life in and around New York City. He always wanted to stay away from Hollywood, but he came to realize movies were generated out in Los Angeles. He was also worried, though, that he was unfinanceable because he'd spent so much time in New York. He'd met some incredible and important people through his successes, and one day while he was packing up his apartment in New York City, he got a call from an acquaintance who wanted to have lunch. That acquaintance? Larry Cohen. Larry had just been fired off a movie and was in New York trying to put together The Ambulance. He'd met with Jake LaMotta for an audition, and as it turned out, LaMotta's nephew came up. Larry says, "Hey, I know that kid. Give me his number." So Larry calls Bill up, they meet for lunch, and while they're sitting at the restaurant waiting for their food, Larry brings up the fact that Maniac didn't have a sequel. Why not? Bill says, "Oh, we never planned on it having a sequel." Then Larry starts talking about the successes of all the cop movies at the time. Beverly Hills Cop, RoboCop, Lethal Weapon. And then he says, "What about a Maniac cop?" So their food arrives, they eat, they chat. By the time their check arrives and they get up to leave, they have a title of the movie and they have a log line. You have the right to remain silent forever. Maniac Cop would be set in New York City, but mostly shot in California. Bill knew, though, that if your movie took place in New York, you had to have a shot of the St. Paddy's Day parade. Now, remember, Bill and Larry met for lunch in early February, which meant the parade was just a month away. So a month later, Bill's hanging out with one of his director friends. That friend? Sam Raimi. Now, Raimi was in New York waiting for financing for Darkman to come through, and he and Bill had been hanging out. Bill says to Raimi, "Let's go rent some cameras and shoot the parade." So Bill rents the cameras, calls up a few friends to help, and he and Raimi go down to Fifth Avenue and shoot footage of the cops marching in the parade. Bill also says to Raimi, "I'm gonna need you to be on camera as a reporter." Now, Larry was back in LA, so Bill calls him up and tells him what's going on. 20 minutes later, Larry faxes over some pages of dialogue for Raimi to read on camera, and off they went.
"And so this year's St. Patrick's Day parade continues on schedule, despite speculation that the parade may have been canceled due to fear of violence. Authorities report scores of death threats against the police, plus threats of bombings along the parade route. But this has not deterred a record crowd for turning out for New York's 50th annual St. Patrick's Day parade. What a parade it is. Public outrage over the continued killings by the so-called Maniac Cop have brought many hostile New Yorkers to New York's Fifth Avenue today. Police security forces and the special bomb squads are out in full force, as well as plainclothes detectives who are mixed in with the crowd."
At this point in his career, Sam Raimi was something of a wonder kid with the successes of The Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. So he says to Bill, "You should call Bruce." Bruce Campbell began acting in high school in Michigan in short Super 8 movies with his friend and classmate, you guessed it, Sam Raimi. Campbell graduated and was attending Western Michigan University when his high school pal called and asked him to be in a short he was making called Within the Woods. That short was then used to finance and pitch a feature-length film of the same concept called, you guessed it, The Evil Dead. So Bill calls Bruce Campbell up and says,
"I'm doing this movie in New York. I don't have a script, and we don't really have any characters, but I need you to be in these scenes. Oh, and wear some clothes that we can duplicate later."
So in this footage during the parade in Maniac Cop, you have Bruce Campbell acting in something that doesn't exist yet, and Sam Raimi reading dialogue about characters who have yet to be created.
"Isn't that Forrest? Let's get him!
All right, then!
Hey, yeah. Wait, no, no, no!
No!
Kevin,
oh, let's go.
Let
get him.
Go of me! Can't you see what the hell's going on up there? Listen to me! He's up there!
Take me to the police office!
Don't you go giving any orders!
If I had to put a bullet right between your eyes, and I'd be a hero.
So the parade was shot, Campbell and Raimi did their things, Bill and Larry had a title and a log line, so now it was time to find some money. Bill called up another one of his director friends just to check in and shoot the shit. Nothing more innocent than that, just two friends catching up. The friend? James Glickenhouse. Bill and Glickenhouse had shared an office together in the early 80s, and both had experienced success. Glickenhouse is telling Bill how well he's doing and how money's just rolling in after forming his distribution company with his partner Lenny Shapiro. He asks Bill how he's doing, and Bill says,
"Well, I'd be a very happy man if you gave me $1 million since you're making all this money."
So Glickenhouse says, "You know what? Fuck it. You're right. I'll give you $1 million to go out and make a movie. You haven't made one in 6 years. It was as simple as that. Glickenhouse didn't need to see a script, which they didn't have, by the way. And it's just that he trusted Bill. He had confidence in him. There was a caveat, though. Lenny Shapiro hated the title Maniac Cop. He said it sounded so down market. So in the contract, it said Shapiro had the right to change the title. Thank God it never came to that. So let's take a minute to speak about Larry Cohen. From that very first lunch, it was always going to be Bill directing and Larry writing the script. Bill says, "I learned more about the film business working with Larry Cohen. He's a genius. He's the best idea man I've ever met in my life. I'll tell you the key to Larry. Larry works best under pressure. Give Larry a week to do something and he's not as good had you given him an hour. His films are legendary and the stories of his productions will be taught until the world is no more." So Bill had his initial footage, a little more than $1 million, and now a completed script. When it came time to cast the actual Maniac Cop, Bill remembers a movie he'd seen recently called The Night Stalker with Charles Napier. The villain in the movie really stuck out to Bill, and he just knew this was his Maniac Cop. The problem was, though, that Larry had a different idea of what the cop should look like. Larry wanted someone who was more of a dancer, someone who could be more fluid with their body. But to Bill, this guy, this enormous, hulking monster of a guy, was his guy. Robert Zadar was that guy. Zadar grew up on black and white television and westerns. As a kid, his hero was Jack Palance. Zadar was always rooting for the bad guy and hoped that Shane would get killed instead of Jack Wilson. Zadar began his acting career as an extra in The Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo. He initially had one line in the film, but ended up with seven. He had glorified extra roles in Three's Company and Moonlighting, mainly comedic stuff, but then his agent called and said Bill had requested to see him. Zadar read the script and loved the idea of selling the character of Cordell solely on his body language. So the day of the meeting comes and Bill says he was very anxious just because Zadar had made such an impression on him from The Night Stalker. So Zadar went in and met with Bill and Larry and asked if they wanted him to audition. Bill said, "No, we don't need you to." And Zadar goes, "Well, can I kill you then?" Bill and Larry got nervous, and Zadar says, "Guys, I'm just joking." Bill and Larry say, "You're perfect."
"I know it would be safe if you put the girl away, but this way is even better. Now they think they got the guilty man, so that way they're gonna let their guard down and you'll be free to get to the mayor and the commissioner and put an end to this. I knew you had anger in you, Matt, but I thought it would be the dealers and the junkies and all the human garbage that you'd be cleaning the city up. Not all them poor people just minding their business. What's got into you, Matt? What's changed you so? I said that I'd stick by you, and I will. But you gotta stop this killing. Just only save it for those that did wrong to you."
For Officer Teresa Mallory, Bill and Larry called in Lorene Landon, one of Larry's regulars, who had appeared in Full Moon High, Eye of the Jury, The Stuff, and It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive. Landon attended the police academy right out of high school, but never graduated because she could never get herself to shoot a gun. So she turned to modeling and started acting as an extra before getting offered bigger roles. And for the final major role in Maniac Cop, that of Detective Frank McRae, Bill called legendary character actor Tom Atkins. Bill sent Atkins the script, which he liked, and Atkins agreed to do the movie. There's one thing, though. When Bill and Atkins first met, Atkins says, "This guy seems too important to the film to be gone so quick." Atkins thought he'd be the star of the picture, which in my mind he is, but he was clearly disappointed the character of McRae didn't run very long. Bill gave a brief and final answer, "No, that's the way we want it." To fill in other roles here and there, Bill and Larry tapped the talents of other character actors like Richard Roundtree of Shaft fame, William Smith from Laredo, CC and Company, Piranha and Red Dawn, and Sherry North from Charlie Varick. When asked why Tennant always cast character actors, Bill said, "These are good, solid actors." He says, "What I find difficult about filmmaking is when the hardest work isn't about the work. It's about the politics. The actors are going crazy on you and egos. That unfortunately happens quite often in this business. And we didn't have any of that on this picture. They had a tiny budget and very little time. I think some actors really work best when they know they have a very brief time to get the scene right," Bill says. "They have to be better prepared. We never had to wait on the actors. They were always there and knew what to do. I think it becomes difficult to shoot fast if you don't have a script that isn't put together well. If you have a script where everyone is insecure about it, it causes a lot of waste of time. We had a really good script to work with." That speaks to the ethics of these character actors who had appeared in countless genre films, as well as the genius of Larry Cohen. "A budget does not correlate to imagination," says Bill. "You can't put value on imagination. It really comes down to the script." Filming got underway back in California, mostly in downtown LA, San Pedro, and the harbor area. Bill remembers a night where the whole crew was staying at this hotel and everyone had found their way into his room. "We all crowded in my room and we were going over the production. I remember we had pizza boxes all over the room. Everybody was there to make a movie. We had so much fun. It was really a team where there was no egos. Everybody was there just to do their best, and we just had a really good time and had a lot of laughs." To be honest, there isn't much in the details of the making of Maniac Cop. The main takeaway here is that everybody involved, from Bill to the actors to the PAs to the gaffers to whoever, were there to make a movie. "We're all grown-up babies watching these movies," he says, "and everyone involved in filming were just grown-up babies making this movie." For instance, Larry only visited the set one day on production during the filming of the transition scene. It's when Bruce is running out of the station with Landon while Zadar's going on his rampage. Bruce's character confronts two cops and tells them to lie down with their faces on the ground. While they're shooting that very brief scene, Larry whispers in Bill's ear, "When the camera pans down to the cops, don't cut. Just let it roll for a little while." Bill's like, okay, weird, but fine. So they shoot the scene, the camera pans to the cops on the floor, they let it roll for a minute, and then cut. So Bill turns to Larry and says, "Okay, Larry, why did I just do this?" Larry goes, "Well, Bruce is saying, I didn't do it, I'm innocent. We'll do some voiceovers for the cops on the floor." So Larry scribbles some lines on scratch paper, and you have Bill and Larry doing this dubbing for the two cops. "That's typical Larry," says Bill, "someone who thinks fast."
"Don't even try."
"Okay, okay.
Listen, I didn't do any of this."
"Sure you didn't.
Put your guns over there. All right. On your face, both of you."
"Hey, man, I'm going after him."
"You heard him. He didn't do it."
Bill says what he learned from Larry was how to work pragmatically. How to find simple solutions when solving problems. We're in a business that tends to make things more complicated than they really are. Larry doesn't believe in the traditions of filmmaking. You need a camera, some film, someone to work the camera, someone to operate the sound, and we can just run and shoot it. We can work out of our station wagon and get things done. The Larry School of practical filmmaking. When it came time to creating their monster, Bill says the makeup was never really solidified. Bill's concept of Maniac Cop was Frankenstein meets the French Connection. We were going to make the first horror police thriller. Most exteriors were shot in New York City, which lends itself to a gorgeous film noir look, both beautiful and frightening at night. So they didn't want Maniac Cop to be funny per se. We all know horror and comedy are two sides of the same coin. It's finding that right balance that can make or break a movie. So Cordell was originally scripted to be more of a Dirty Harry type of character, but he was still a monster. After all, this is technically a slasher movie. The pre-production period was very short here, so they didn't have enough time to really fine-tune the makeup for the cop. It always kind of changed from shot to shot. Bill considers that one of the flaws of the film. In the original one, Cordell was kept in the shadows deliberately because they had never had the makeup down right. What Bill was desperately trying to avoid in Maniac Cop was creating a sarcastic character. New Line was already on the fourth Nightmare on Elm Street at this point, and Freddy Krueger had just become a comedian. Friday the 13th was up to 7 films, and even Jason's kills were done more for laughs and entertainment value rather than scares. Bill aimed never to make the Maniac Cop comical. Humorous situations with other characters were going to be there, sure, especially with Bruce Campbell in there, but the Maniac Cop himself was never meant to be some wisecracking monster.
"This is it, Jennifer. Your big break in TV.
Everybody remembers the process of making Maniac Cop rather fondly. Dan Hicks called Bill Lustig very childlike and energetic. Atkins said Bill was an odd young man at the time, but still very fun and easy to work with. Atkins remembers the scene where he and William Smith are sitting in the bar and Bill knew exactly what he wanted and just said, go. He had a very straightforward style of directing. Again, this just goes back to Bill hiring character actors who knew how to work efficiently. Everybody knew their shit. Robert Zadar was game for just about anything. He was a method actor who took his craft seriously. Atkins says, I don't have much to say about Zadar except that he got physical and I tried to get physical. Zadar told Bill, I'll do anything. Jump out of a window, beat anybody up, set me on fire, whatever. By the way, this is the exact reason Robert Zadar had two hip replacements. There is one thing he wouldn't do though. He wasn't willing to drive the paddy wagon off the pier at the end. He left that one up to stunt coordinator Spiro Rosados. Zadar had fond memories of everyone on set. He called Atkins a very underrated actor. Bruce Campbell, one of the most underrated comedic people you'll ever meet in your life. And Loreen Landon? Well, how personal do you want to get? Let's just say we're very close and we know each other. She's a great woman. The process of Maniac Cop went very quickly. Bill and Larry met for lunch in early February. They shot the St. Paddy's Day Parade in March, and 6 months later, the film was wrapped, cut, and printed. Maniac Cop opened on May 13th, 1988 to limited release alongside, you guessed it, Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. It only earned a little less than 700 grand, but gained enough cult status to warrant two more sequels. On a normal episode of Neon Badges, I usually read three reviews, and one of them usually from Roger Ebert. Roger Ebert didn't even take the time to watch Maniac Cop. Other critics did, though, and boy howdy did they have some things to say. Karen James of the New York Times wrote, there was an intriguing half minute during a showing of Maniac Cop yesterday when the film broke. The flaring orange on screen at least livened up this amateurish effort about a monstrously strong uniformed policeman. Or is he a civilian in costume? The acting is stiff, the dialogue is stiffer, and the action scenes are laborious. Even the presence of professionals like Sherry North and Richard Roundtree in small roles tend to diminish them rather than improve the film. With no advanced screenings, no publicity agents pushing information about the people responsible for this disaster, it's hard to know where this film came from. That doesn't really matter, as long as it goes away soon. In Bill's defense, does Miss James really think there was money for advanced screenings and publicity agents? And how about a quick word from Variety? Maniac Cop is a disappointing thriller that wastes an oddball premise and offbeat point of view. Acting is deadpan and straight ahead. My question for Variety is there such thing as wasting an oddball premise and offbeat point of view? Richard Harrington from the Washington Post saw the movie too. About the only people likely to enjoy Maniac Cop are maniac moviegoers, and even they may feel cheated. This film was written and produced by veteran schlockmeister Larry Cohen, but Dirty Larry it's not. In fact, the script is at once so undernourished and so obvious that you'll be convinced Cohen produced it via telegram. Start. Maniac Cop kills civilians. Stop. Clean cut gets blamed. Stop. World-weary detective figures it out. Stop. Bodies fall. Stop. Stop indeed. Maniac Cop, directed by William Lustig in lackluster fashion, is not that much more complicated. The best line is in the ad, you have the right to remain silent forever. Unfortunately, that's the only place you'll find it. As for the Maniac Cop, when he finally does appear in good light at the film's end, he looks like a Jim Henson creation. My question for Mr. Harrington, is that last line supposed to be a dig? If so, who are you hating on? The makeup crew for Maniac Cop or Jim Henson? And finally, Chris Willman of the LA Times. Maniac Cop is the kind of movie that begs to have a title theme song, maybe by Michael Cimbello. He's a maniac, maniac on the force, and he's dicing like he's never diced before. It also begs for an anarchic camp approach, or else a deeper exploitation of the very real fears the common citizenry have of men in blue in so many urban climes nowadays. An action horror film masochist might settle for just the song even, but this cop is batting 0 for 3. That's a surprise coming from writer-producer Larry Cohen. Interest dissipates when the bad guy turns out to be just another mindlessly vengeful, indestructible Jason figure with a half-baked version of Freddy Krueger's makeup job, no less. In the goofiest sequence, the villain's single-handed slaughter of an entire station house edges into Terminator territory. Sayeth Maniac Critic, you have the right to remain at home. No questions for Mr. Willman. A-plus review. Tom Atkins and Bruce Campbell are still plugging away, acting in some of our favorite genre films. While Bruce Campbell has pretty much disowned Maniac Cop, Atkins says he liked it. He really liked the script, although he's not sure they got what they had written up on the screen. He says the first and only time he saw it was on a VHS screener Bill had sent him that said not for distribution on the bottom of the screen throughout the entire movie. He says he was surprised Maniac Cop films kept coming out. And McRae isn't necessarily one of his favorite roles. Those belong to his performances in Night of the Creeps and Lethal Weapon. Robert Zadar was proud of his role in the franchise. He first saw Maniac Cop at its theatrical debut in California, and he thought the film was brilliant. Take that, Bruce Campbell and Tom Atkins! Zadar says he gained a huge fan base of law enforcement officers from his role as Matt Cordell. He would ask these people, "What's your fascination with this character? And are you all ready for the not at all surprising response?" These cops would say to him, "You're our stress relief. We wish we could do what you do and get away with it. It's not only revenge, it's a reckoning." Robert Zadar sadly passed away on March 30th, 2015 while in Pensacola, Florida for a convention. William Lustig always had low self-esteem as a filmmaker, and it wasn't until his company Blue Underground did the 4K restoration of Maniac that he realized he wasn't too bad of a filmmaker, and he calls Maniac Cop a tight little B-movie. "It's a film I'm really proud of," he says. "I'm not embarrassed for people to see it today. We cared and put a great deal of effort into it." Now, like I said earlier, Maniac Cop had enough ravenous fans that Bill and Larry made two more of them. And then on March 23rd, 2019, Larry Cohen passed away at his home in Beverly Hills at the age of 82. And we'll end things with a final word from Bill Lustig. "We were making films for the audience, not for acclaim on Facebook and Twitter. We looked at ourselves as kind of unimportant, nothing more than blue-collar workers." Thank you all so much for listening and watching, and thank you to Salem Horror Fest for allowing me to tell the story of a beloved genre classic. If you enjoyed it, you can become a supporter of Neon Badges on Patreon at patreon.com/neonbadges for the low, low price of only $1 per month. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram and Letterboxd at AK Donnelly. That's AKDONELLY. My name is Anthony King, and I will see you all next time.